for everyone listening, this is the first time I'm introducing this show, and Aaron's just making me laugh. So everyone, welcome to the Alamo City Investing Show with your hosts, Jason Lee and Aaron Beal. This is the first time I'm introducing the episode. We have so very historic moment, and also historic because we just hit episode number 10. So welcome to episode 10. Thank you to everyone that's been listening so far, and please continue to share so we can get more listeners. But it's good to be back. I was gone the last couple episodes.
I feel like this is where we like reference like how no podcasts make it to episode 10 and reference statistics we don't know and all that stuff. So we've made it. We're here. And it's alive and well and growing, and life's good.
Aaron's referring to some statistic that I'm going to completely butcher this, so feel free to check me. But they said, I think it's like 2% of podcasts make it past 10 episodes. So just continuing to stick with it. A little pat on the back to us.
Yep. So Jason's back this week after, you know, hopefully you guys enjoyed the past few weeks with JP. Dude has a pretty wild story. And, you know, it's kind of still being written, which is fun. So this week we kind of have a, you know, variety of topics we're going to kind of go over and just kind of an update show because we haven't done one of these in a while. Jason is back in the United States of America. He was in Dominican Republic, I guess, what, a few weeks ago now?
Yeah, it's been 2 weeks
now. As of this recording. What were you doing there? Anything you want to tell us about your trip? What do we need to know about Jason in the Dominican Republic?
So I had a great time in the Dominican. This was less of a leisure trip, more of a work trip. So I went on a medical mission trip with myself and my wife, and my wife's part of an organization called CMDA, or Christian Medical Dental Association. So shout out to those guys. And basically what they do is they locally and internationally go to places where people don't have access to medical and dental treatment, and they perform free care for those people. So they partnered with a mission group and some churches over in the Dominican Republic, and we spent a little over a week there just going to a little bit more remote parts, treating the locals there. And yeah, it was a great time. I am not a medical professional, so I was not pulling out teeth. I did assist my wife here and there, and I was a little bit more in charge of logistical stuff, the clinic management, and making a lot of balloon animals. So if anyone needs to learn how to make, I can make a sword, I can make a dog, I can make a flower and a giraffe, because a giraffe is just a dog with a long neck. So if anyone needs to learn how to do that, hit me up.
Yeah, and like a week ago, he was like, I can do fillings, like I'm pretty much a dentist now. Like I've never done it, but it's probably not that hard. So if Gayla's listening, sorry. Jason's just discounting your whole education and career and thinks he can do it after watching for a week.
My wife is, everyone laughs because people say Dr. Lee and they just assume it's me, but that is my wife. She's much smarter than me, and there's no way I could survive any type of medical school or dental school.
Yeah, well, good deal. Yeah, so glad you're back. Glad you survived all that good stuff. And then, I don't know, I guess it was probably a week or so ago, I just want to share a little bit about an event that I was at in Austin. So one of our, you know, friends we've kind of met through social media, Aaron Amuchastegui, has this event mainly for realtors. I feel like I always say that word wrong and someone's going to hate it because I add a syllable there.
It's realtors.
But I know it's realtors, but I say realtors. And
it's fine.
I hate it and everyone hates it.
It's fine. Some people just get really butthurt on the whole thing. I think it's funny.
Yeah. So an event for real estate agents, which I'm not really, but it's interesting to hear because so I've been to it twice now and the market right now is rough. I mean, there's places where it's not, but pretty much everywhere there's challenges. But it's always interesting for me to hear, you know, different strategies, people in kind of an adjacent industry and like what they do to have success. You know, everyone kind of does things different, which for me just kind of gets the creative juices flowing a little bit of, you know, there's a guy there that all he does is make YouTube videos for lead generation. There's people that all they do are paid ads. And then there's people that all they do is generate leads and refer them because they would rather refer them than, you know, represent folks or do whatever. So it's always really interesting to see, even in the same industry, like people do things completely different. And we've seen this with people we know of you know, they build their whole business on referrals and, you know, word of mouth. And that's not really us, but when we interact with those people, it's always really interesting because, you know, we're like, cool, well, we can definitely learn from this. So that's always fun being around. I mean, other entrepreneurs, other high level operators is always a good time, but it's just interesting to hear some of the different perspectives on, you know, what works for different people and just get different ideas. And it's hard not to leave something like that and want to do like 5,000 different things. And like, I'm going to be the YouTube guy. I'm going to be this guy. I'm going to be that guy. But it's really good for, you know, giving ideas, giving perspective on stuff. And honestly, just hearing other people talk about similar stuff is always helpful.
And so that Real Estate Rockstar event, and that's the name of it. I don't know if you had mentioned it, but that Real Estate Rockstar event, yeah. Is that a little bit more, was the purpose of that just to share what's working for them and kind of teach people how to build their business? Or were they also giving market updates and that sort of thing too?
Kind of all that stuff. I mean, it's I guess born out of kind of the podcast they run for real estate agents, and they've created an event for it. So, you know, there's some market updates. There's like a CPA who spoke. There's, you know, some more like mindset stuff, and then like, you know, tactical, you know, strategy stuff with, you know, how people do listing presentation. You know, it was kind of all across the board as far as stuff with agents, and just kind of the audience and the focus of that.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's always cool hearing their perspective on things, especially with like market updates and what they're seeing, because, you know, if all you're doing is wholesaling, you're mainly working with investors. But once you're getting into the flipping world and stuff, that's when you're dealing with more on the retail side, and also just like sourcing deals from agents too. A lot of people, like, we'll source some of our deals from referrals from agents. So it's always interesting hearing, it's like a lot of similarities, but there's just so many differences too with what they do.
Well, and it's good for me to be around agents that are like high level operators, because my default feelings about agents is that they're all like a pain in the ass and really dumb, which like, unfortunately, like that's not the case, but those are the ones that stand out. Like even from an example today, we got an offer on a $700,000 house and they wanted to put down $5,000 in earnest money and ask us to do an inspection for them. And I'm like, what are we doing here? And our agent's like, well, I'm pretty sure it's his first transaction or first transaction this year or whatever. And it's like, unfortunately, that is like what most of us think about with agents, not the ones that actually do their jobs well. So it's good to be around people that operate at a high level to be a very like constant reminder to me that like they exist.
Very much the 80-20.
Because we just see a lot of really bad stuff.
Very much the 80-20 rule, where 20% of the agents are doing 80% of the work, 80% are doing 20. And unfortunately, just with the, as much as we do, we usually deal with more not so great agents than we do some the good ones. But the good ones are always a nice breath of fresh air.
Well, right now, it's just, we just don't have as many options. Like a few years ago, we would have, you know, done our homework and said, hey, we have three offers. Like this one clearly is the least competent. I won't say they're incompetent, but hey, this is the least competent of the agents we have. Like we don't want to work with them. Now it's very much, you have one offer, let's try to keep it together. So that's just kind of what we're up against. So you can't really be like, hey, I'm saying no to the offer because the agent's maybe not, you know, the most experienced, even if you want to. So that's just the kind of world we're currently living in.
Well, yeah.
What else do we have going on, Jason, that may be interesting to some listeners?
Sure. And one last point to that is it really just becomes unfair to the other agent in the transaction when one of them's not able to pull their weight. So a good example for us is one of my guys, Chris. There's been multiple times on a few deals where the other agent is dead, radio silent, not really helping out with the transaction. And Chris, we're selling a property, and Chris is on the phone with the buyer's lender and trying to get the buyer's lending situation all worked out. And to me, that's a buyer's agent thing. But a lot of times, because we don't have options, like you said, the other agent's forced to jump in, carry the other person's weight just to get to the closing line. But yeah, and we'll later on in the show, actually, we're going to talk about the NAR, or the National Association of Realtor Settlement, and we'll kind of tie it all together. But other stuff we got going on, there's the what I call the big boy expensive one, Thunder Ridge. That's one that we had bought, how long has it been now? Like 5 months, 4 months,
Three or four months.
So this
end of last year.
Yeah, this is the most expensive house that we've bought for $2.1 million, and a lot of updates. So we had it listed at $2.65 million, and holding costs are pretty crazy as people can imagine. So I think right now our holding costs are like $14,000 a month on that. But we had tenants moved in. I guess there was someone in the neighborhood, their house had flooded. The insurance company needs to do some repairs, so they asked if we could house them as temporary tenants for a while, which seemed like a great idea because we were able to offset some of our holding costs. But it's kind of been a pain because these tenants are, they live in a nice neighborhood and they expect a nice product, and they are used to things, I guess, being done very, very fast and at a premium. And they're not willing to really help out with any repairs.
And I mean, I get it. They're paying $15,000 a month or whatever in rent. I mean, the insurance is, but it's like the most, with the number of requests and the type of requests we've gotten from them, you would think that they're living in like a shack that's like completely run down. And this is a 7,600 square foot house that's like 10 years old. So has some of been helpful in kind of figuring out some of the stuff that needs repairs? Yes. But when there's like, you know, the constant complaining because the one of the two light bulbs in the $20,000 refrigerator doesn't work. I mean, it's like that kind of stuff. Like, I don't like the shower. There, I don't have any issues with pests, but I want to make sure pest control is here right now. And it's like, I mean, you've dealt with this more than I have, but it's like, oh, I need records on when the reverse osmosis filtration system was last serviced. And it's like, no, you don't need any of this. Like, but it's just kind of became, it's nice, but it's a nightmare. And are they still there? I don't even know the latest on that.
Yeah, they're still there. So I basically just got a laundry list of repair items, everything ranging from, hey, something's wrong with the well pump, which stuff like that needs to be addressed, to the fire alarm's beeping because the battery needs to be changed. And they would rather sit there and listen to the beeps for a whole day and wait for a repairman than just to swap the batteries themselves.
Or even things like, hey, the light in the hallway needs a new light bulb. It's like, okay, like we can fix that, but you could also just get a light bulb. Like, you know, things that are very normal.
So, yeah, so it was a whole thing of differentiating what actually needs to get done and what's a nice to have. For example, there's a hot tub there, and the hot tub, I guess, needs to be cleaned. And to me, I'm like, well, you'll be able to sleep if you can't use a hot tub for the day. So eventually it got too much, and I hit up my property manager that manages our long-term rentals. I asked if she takes on this sort of thing. Thankfully, she said yes, she took it on. She gave me, I don't know, like $300 a month, I think is what she's charging me. But that's, to me, a steal for not having to deal with the tenants. And as of right now, they're still in there, and we are still working through some of those repairs. So that's the tenant side of things.
Yeah. Last week, they wanted to break their lease because they said it's uninhabitable, which is like the only reason they can break their lease, according to kind of what we have. So they're telling us the house is uninhabitable. So fun times with high maintenance renters. The other thing with that house is we finally accepted an offer on it. Went under contract. They wanted, it's like a 14-day option, and they had like inspections on anything you could inspect. And then they asked for a $200,000 discount. You know, they wanted a brand new metal roof. They wanted $15,000 in carpet because some of this stuff, it's like, cool, you know, we'll be reasonable. We'll repair things if they need repaired. But a lot of it just kind of came down to like preference of, we don't like the carpet upstairs, replace the carpet. One of my personal favorites was, so obviously there's like pretty extensive landscaping on this house. There's, you know, stonework, tile work, pretty much all on the outside. And they wanted, what was it, like $60,000 or $80,000 to replace all the tile because they said some of it's sharp.
54,000.
Some of the edges are sharp.
Yeah, 54,000.
54,000 because some of the edges of the tile are sharp. So, there were some reasonable things in there. And then there was a lot of like, hey, we want $50,000 or $40,000 to resurface the pool and put a new pump in. It's like, there's a difference in like, hey, things are broken and like this would be really nice to have.
Yeah, or some of the window seals, I guess, are broken or a little bit older. So they said, hey, we'd like you to replace 22 windows for $20,000. So that's just the stuff. So again, we see it on both the tenant side and also any sort of buyers. And that's just, I guess, the thing that you get with these higher priced homes. I know in California, a $2.1 million house might be fairly normal, but out here in San Antonio area, like Aaron said, you get a 7,700 square foot house with a pool on how many acres is it? It's on like
9.5
acres with the barn. So it gets you a lot, but there's people expect a lot, I guess, at that price point.
Which is interesting because I feel like the other higher price point stuff we've done in the past, people are normally more laid back and almost more reasonable. But this one, you know, it's presented some challenges. Even some of the showings we had, like we had one person look at it, they liked it, but then they gave the feedback that they were upset there was only one toilet in the master bathroom, which I don't know that I've ever seen two toilets in a master bathroom. Maybe that's a thing. What was the other one? There's only one closet, I think, was the other complaint.
Well, there was another one they didn't like the barn. Oh, then
one didn't like the barn.
Yeah.
The one I'm thinking of complained about there only being one closet in the master, but like the master bedroom has, so there's like the master bedroom with a, you know, fireplace TV. There's a room off of the master bedroom that's like an exercise room with another TV and mirrors and like whole setup for like a, you know, workout room. And then there's a kitchen / laundry room. Like not the normal kitchen and laundry room, but like a separate one on the master. And then there's like a closet that's the size of bigger than a normal size bedroom with a giant like island in the middle that like you could live in. But they complain that there's only one toilet and not two closets. So yeah, that one's been interesting. So lots of interesting feedback. And I feel like people just act like it's completely run down by the kind of the things they say.
But so that's going on. What is some other stuff going on? I think we are been pretty busy as far as wholesaling goes. As a company, we started to make the shift towards wholesaling more. The last couple of years, we were doing a lot of wholetailing and a lot of flipping, but we've shifted more towards a wholesaling model, and we're still in the process of that. But Aaron, do you want to kind of get into maybe why we started to do that?
Yeah, and we've maybe talked about this a little in the past, but I feel like we've changed kind of as the market changes and, you know, with our resources and strengths and all that. So we were flipping a lot last year and it just kind of came to the point where stuff sells, it just takes forever. And our main GC that was kind of our main guy for the past 2 years kind of just decided he wanted to focus on doing flooring, not be a GC. And that just kind of aligned with us being like, man, we've been flipping a lot of these houses and we don't love it. So for us, it's not like we think it's a bad thing. It's flipping at volume and scale is complicated. It's very like capital intensive. You're always like, hey, this sells, but we're already spending that money somewhere else. And then it's become a lot more challenging when we're trying to flip 5, 10, 15 houses a month or have that many going on at a time when, you know, things take three times as long to sell, or it's just more unpredictable. We still think it's a good thing to do. And as a one-off, like, hey, flip a house or a few houses, but trying to do that at scale just became a thing that we're like, it's almost like its own business. And we're kind of like, we just want to get away from it unless it's something that, you know, maybe we do one at a time and it's a more high end, you know, higher price point sort of thing, or, you know, maybe it's something that's super easy and it makes a lot of sense. But in general, we're kind of moving towards the, hey, we want to do more volume. We want things to move faster. It's also a lot easier on our business to pay people out when we get paid, instead of a lot of times we're paying people out of pocket. We're carrying those costs until months down the line when we actually get paid on something when it sells. So there's just a lot of things where I think we're just kind of worn out on flipping, and it just became a thing that we're like, maybe we should wholesale more. What does that look like? You know, what do those timelines look like? Can we, you know, turn things around faster? You know, ultimately, if we figure this out, can we increase volume? So that's, I guess, a little of the behind the scenes on why we're doing that, what that move looks like. And Jason, I'm sure you can add to some of that as well.
And before, what our company had looked like was we were, if I'm looking at some stats from last year, we had wholesaled maybe 25% of the deals that we had last year. So one of every four. But just to give you guys an idea of how much of a push we're moving towards for wholesaling, I think this week we had, or the last past week, we've had five closings, and four of the five have been wholesaling. So we shifted from 25% to 80% of our deals that we're not wholesaling. And one of our guys right now, Mark, we hired him on as an acquisition guy. So he was trying to go, you know, work with sellers to find deals, and we're slowly transitioning him over to a full-time dispo guy. So getting to build relationships with good buyers in the area, so that way we have deals, he is able to dispo or sell those deals or assign those deals to end buyers. So that's kind of what we're doing now. We definitely don't have it all built out yet. We're still on that transition period, but I'm excited for where things are going. I think that a lot of movement and changes are happening with the company, but I think it's all good. And I think everyone's on board to grow the company in that way.
Yeah. So for us, it's just a lot of moving people around and kind of moving pieces of, like, from an employee kind of standpoint, like, do we have the capacity to still look at all the houses? If we move Mark from acquisitions to dispo, do we have the capacity that he's making enough money and has enough opportunity if we move him there? So those are a lot of the things we kind of have going on. But the cool thing is we've just never really, like, invested into it, right? Like, you know, we've always been kind of lazy with all that. And then we've kind of just committed to it, and it's happening. So, you know, and some of that's like, you know, we've been pretty strategic about, you know, relationships and building out, you know, partnerships and stuff with different buyers, talking to, you know, hard money lenders. We have good relationships and kind of trying to become everyone's kind of preferred source for deals, which takes time. But the cool thing too is through this, Mark, our guy, has found lots of new buyers we had no relationship with. So just by, like, kind of pounding the phones of, you know, we found, you know, people in the area we've never wholesaled, and it's just a random that he's like, cool, this guy buys houses cash. And, you know, he's not afraid to hop on the phone and talk to these people. Hey, what are you looking for? So really trying to get to the point where it's not so much that we, you know, have the biggest list of buyers and, you know, it's this huge impersonal thing, but more so that we have a small list of really solid buyers, and we know, hey, as soon as I get this lot in this area, this is who I call because they like it, right? So that's the direction we're going with that. And we have a lot of room to grow, but it's nice to feel like we're, you know, kind of making progress with that. And we're kind of getting to the point where we get a deal and we send it to Mark and we're like, figure it out. And he does. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. With that being said, if anyone listening is looking for their next deal to flip, maybe a rental property, feel free to reach out to us. We'll put you in touch with Mark and he will be sending you deals. So, but on to the
next. And if you don't act quick, it will be gone because we sell stuff quick. So I'll plug that a little bit. But no, in like all seriousness, most of our stuff we are either selling before we send it out, or we're sending it out and kind of immediately have someone jump on it. So, you know, if people are wishy-washy, things are gone. So yeah. So, you know, if you're looking to buy and you're serious, let us know. We'll connect you with Mark and we can find you something. But enough on that. Let's talk San Antonio market update. So if you're watching this on YouTube, which I keep saying and then keep not posting it on YouTube, hopefully you'll see this. But this is let me pull it up. Just kind of infographic from our local board of realtors that shows some of these statistics. There we go. So wanted to talk about some of this, and we'll kind of interject what we're seeing, what we're feeling, all that stuff. I'll kind of just quickly go over some of this, and then, you know, Jason and I can kind of give our thoughts on it. So this is from February. This is usually delayed I don't know, a month or so. And this comes from our local MLS and Board of Realtors. The other really good source for this information would be like Redfin. On a national level, anytime I'm looking at other markets, I look at Redfin. So if you're listening, you're not in San Antonio, that's where I would go. This closed a list price. So things are selling at average of, you know, 7% less than the list price. That's stayed pretty much the same. Our days on market up to 80 days. Last month, that was 70 something. I believe this is year over year, it's up 11%. Price per square foot, which I don't really look at that. Apparently it's down. Months of inventory stayed pretty much the same since last month. So 4.3. So we're definitely, you know, creeping up on months of inventory. Active listings have stayed year over year. We're up, which is crazy, 24%. Month over month, it's pretty much the same. We've been hovering around that 12,000 active listings for probably 3 or 4 months now. Pending listings, not changing too much, but yeah, so I mean, that's kind of the quick rundown of the latest as far as statistics in San Antonio. What are your thoughts on that, Jason?
So the thing that sticks out to me the most, and probably to anyone else looking at that, was the average days on market. So up 11%. And that, I think that chart you said was year over year. And to me, that is pretty significant, especially in the investment space when you're talking about flips, you know, and trying to sell property and that sort of thing, because that when you're flipping a property, more than likely you're taking on a hard money loan or some kind of loan to fix up that property and purchase it. And so you have holding costs tied to that property. And that means that you now have to 11% more of like holding costs are you have to account for. And not just that, but like you also can pretty much like price a property. Like it can be perfectly priced. You can even, you know, undervalue it. And that still means that on average, it could just sit on the market for 80 days. Like you could do everything right. And it's going to take almost 3 months to get that thing under contract. So that's probably the most glaring statistic and the one that jumps out to me immediately.
Yeah. And I think the thing with that too is like, it's hard because I mean, I'm not patient. You're not super patient. But for us, it's like we want to move stuff. So, but a lot of that, we've definitely seen that. Like we've had stuff priced right. We have showings. We've all of that stuff. And it still just takes time. I saw another investor we know locally that kind of showed the same thing. Nice house, entry level price point, nice flip, you know, took 75 days and 50 showings to get an offer or whatever. Right. So, and when we talk to other people in the space locally, other investors, we know lenders, everyone kind of, I feel like is expressing the same sentiment of, yeah, things are taking longer. You know, it's things aren't selling first week very often. So that's the one thing that, you know, not to go back to flipping and stuff, but, you know, one thing that's kind of steered us away from that a little bit is, you know, stuff just takes longer. It can be priced right. Like we have a townhouse in Terrell Hills right now, really cool place, really nice rehab, all of those things, a ton of showings. And we finally went under contract this week. We've had some offers here and there, went under contract once, but it was like, all of these people were like, oh yeah, we love it. And it's like, do you want to buy it? And they're like, well, we don't know. So that's the one thing that I think we're seeing a ton of. It almost seems it seems like a lot more people are like looking at houses, but people still aren't buying, which I think equates to, you know, some of the stuff on interest rates coming down, you know, the Fed kind of signaling, hey, we're going to have this number of rate cuts this year. And I think people are kind of like window shopping, expecting rate cuts, but not ready to pull the trigger because they haven't happened. Because I would say our showings have been up, right?
The showings this past, I would say the past month, they've gone up. It was a little bit slow in the wintertime, but it's been picking up.
But even like we had a mobile home in Blanco. It's practically brand new. It's what, a year old, 2 years old? Nice mobile home, 2,100 square feet. It's on like a half acre. Like we priced it lower than anything else. We've price dropped it. We've had three showings, but two of those want to make offers. So now we're under contract and it, you know, it should be fine. But there's just so much of that where, hey, it can be priced right, but it just might take some time to have someone come across it that, you know, fits their needs or is what they're looking for. But we've seen with that product in particular, we've seen that before of we've had these mobile homes that are really nice in, you know, less popular areas. And it's like, especially when it's a really nice mobile home, like we know if you show it, you probably like it. Like if you want a mobile home in Blanco on a half acre that's brand new, it probably fits. And it's probably going to, you know, exceed your expectations. But it's like finding that person is a lot harder than, you know, a 3-2 in San Antonio.
Yeah, I think that window shopping, that's exactly what I think a lot of people are doing as well. So we have the rate cuts. And then also with the upcoming election cycle too, I feel like both on the buyer's and seller's side, I feel as if I've heard a lot of when Trump's back in office, everything's going to get better and the rates are going to drop and everything's going to get cheaper and or my home value is going to go up once Trump's in office. And it's with people like that, you can't really argue that it doesn't matter who's in office, like the economy kind of does its thing or they're not going to fix it in a couple months, right? But that's what people are.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's people get weird around like decisions with election cycles, it seems like. And it's like we're always like coming in and out of something. I don't know. But that's kind of what the statistics in the market say, but also just kind of what we're, you know, feeling on the side of, you know, we have quite a few listings and whatnot.
So the biggest thing to, I would say, combat, or maybe just the advice that I would give people, and we probably need to take this as advice too, is one, plan for that when it comes to running your numbers, holding costs, all that sort of thing. And two, I would say, set that expectation in your head that, hey, this is normal now. We're no longer in 2021 where stuff should sell after a week or two. Because I think a lot of people are still have that in their head, or they're at least longing for that. And so that 80 days just seems like an eternity to them. But if you come with the mindset of, hey, this is where the market's at now, this is what I should be expecting, I think a lot of unwanted anxiety could be avoided.
For sure. For sure. So enough on that. The next thing we kind of want to jump into, which if you do anything with real estate, I'm sure you've seen this everywhere, but the whole lawsuit and settlement with NAR. So if you're not familiar, I'll share my screen again and kind of give a quick overview of that. And then we can just kind of talk through it and what we think is happening, how we think it's going to impact things and all that good stuff. So they reached a settlement which essentially, you know, NAR was sued for, you know, fixing prices more or less, or, you know, fixing commissions. The whole idea around the seller of a house shouldn't have to pay the buyer's commissions and it shouldn't be fixed. And a lot of that, you know, is happening within the MLS where, you know, the seller signs a listing agreement for 6%. The buyer, you know, the listing agent gets 3%. Then they in the MLS will put the whatever amount that is, which is normally 3%. So that's kind of what that came out of. But, you know, kind of what's in that settlement, which I think like when this case came up, everyone thought it would change things, but I don't think anyone would, you know, thought things would happen that quick. But yeah, so they settled, and essentially the big, you know, changes now is just how, you know, how commission's going to work. Not necessarily like buyer's agents aren't going to get paid, but the MLS kind of having a part in that is definitely changing. So, you know, historically, you know, you list a property for 5 or 6% commission, half goes to the buyer's agent, half goes to the seller. You know, so the buyer doesn't, everyone who's bought a house, you know, as a buyer, you don't pay for the agent, it's paid for by the seller. And, you know, this is all around that kind of, you know, not being fair, right? So what does that look like for, you know, buyers and sellers now? You know, I think the biggest thing is NAR pretty much said, hey, we're not putting that in the MLS anymore. So, you know, you kind of have to negotiate that directly. And it's not to the point where buyers are paying commission when they buy a house. That's not fixed. That's not in the MLS. You know, we're probably heading towards a, you know, pay per service, not you know, a percent commission, all that good stuff. But yeah, so that is kind of the gist of that is, you know, since the settlement, they immediately came out and said, hey, you know, we're not putting, you know, commissions in listing agreements anymore. And they, you know, have required that, you know, anyone working with a buyer's agent now has to have, you know, representation agreement that, you know, outlines all this. And yeah, so that's kind of, you know, what that is today. And a lot of people are saying, hey, we're just kind of getting caught up to what they do in other countries or how it works in the commercial end. But yeah, that's kind of the big news of that, of, is this going to kill the MLS? Is this going to kill the NAR? Like, what's, you know, what's going to come out of this?
Yeah, and it's interesting. If you go on the NAR, I guess the website, they publish kind of their own, I would call it like story or version of the whole thing. A lot of it is saying that, hey, the news outlets, they have the facts wrong. A good example of this is they're saying that there's a lot of people basically claiming that NAR had set or guided commissions towards that standard rate of 6%, 3 for the buyer, 3 for the seller's agent, that most people are aware of. But they're saying that, like, that's always been the precedent. It wasn't them. And then kind of what Aaron was saying, I mean, they do outline like the two changing business practices that came out of the settlement. The first one being that they're not going to, they're basically prohibited to put in the compensation rates on the MLS. So you can't communicate, you know, how much the buyer's agent is going to get via the MLS. And then second, and this one is probably the more impacting one, is
let me jump in there real quick. And so practically what this looks like, what you may not see or know if you're kind of outside the, you know, real estate industry, is if an agent goes in, not all agents, but this 100% happens. If an agent goes and looks at a listing and sees, hey, they're only offering 2% commission on this instead of 3%, you're not going to get showings, or you're not going to get as many showings. And the agent's not supposed to do that. And they're not supposed to, you know, guide their people away from that stuff based on that. But coming from experience, like even in 2021, when the market was super hot, I'm like, why would I pay 3%? I'll put this one at 2. Suddenly you can't sell a house, right? No one wants to show the house. Or the agents all just send offers and want you to pay them 3% and hope you don't notice, even though you've outlined that's going to be 2%. So, and then the other side of that, I'm in, you know, a local realtor group, and the only thing I ever see is new builds and their higher commissions. And a lot of these agents are like, oh, I stopped showing in that community because they don't do 5% commission anymore. They're back to 3. Oh, I don't bring my clients here because they don't have the $10,000 bonus anymore. So that's kind of the other side of that and what some of that practically looks like. What you want to think, like, hey, they really have my best interest in mind. But if you're between the house that's, you know, house in a neighborhood that's only 2 or 3%, or you can get the new build that pays incentives and bonuses and twice the commission, who knows, you know, what they may, you know, guide you towards.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Anyway.
Yeah, that's a great point, especially because a lot of people don't see that every single day. And so that's not a change that a lot of people will even really notice, because that goes on a lot behind the scenes. And the other change that's happening, which this is the one that most people are talking about, because this is the one that most people, it's most apparent to the public, is they basically created a new rule requiring that MLS participants, so anyone that's listing on the MLS, working with buyers, that they have to enter into a written agreement with buyers before doing any kind of home tour. So if I'm a buyer, Aaron's an agent, and I want to go check out this house over here, Aaron and I need to have like a written agreement as far as, hey, I'm going to
make like a representation,
yeah, representation agreement for us to go check out a house that is listed on the MLS of the market. And so that's when people are starting to talk about buyers are now having to pay for the buyer's agent commissions, and buyer's agents can now set their own prices, whether that's a percentage, a flat rate, whatever it is. That's where that talk is stemming from, is this rule.
Yeah. And as far as immediate changes, I don't think we're going to see anything immediately. Where I see this going, though, is I think it's going to wash out bad agents. I think that industry is going to be wiped away. Because one thing that, like, when I was an agent that made me not like being an agent is you do the same work on every single property, but your pay is dictated by the purchase price, right? Or the sale price, whatever side you're on, right? And for me, that was not a good thing because I was selling cheap houses, you know, so cool, 3% on a $150,000 house, you know, you're getting $4,500, you're splitting that 70-30, 60-40 with your brokerage, you know, you walk away with a few thousand dollars. You do that on a $700,000 house, you're then splitting $21,000. It's the same amount of work, potentially less work because people have more money and they're less needy a lot of times, the more they can afford. So to me, that was always a bad side of like, hey, why I don't like being an agent, because I was selling cheap stuff and you do the same amount of work. But I think on the other side, you know, I think people are eventually going to realize like, man, like, am I really paying, you know, $60,000 to sell my $1 million house? Like, when I could probably pay 10 or 20 or whatever that looks like. So I think you're going to see a lot more like flat fee stuff. I think you're going to see companies and kind of people build out like selling the buyer stuff as a service, right? So right now where that commission's still included, maybe it's something where, hey, like I charge a flat fee and I'll give you that back as, you know, whatever. But I think people eventually, you know, it's going to be a thing of like, maybe you charge people by the hour to consult, or, you know, you pay people to show you houses and then, you know, you pay someone to help you write offers. I think that's all going to be a lot more fragmented when, you know, people realize like, hey, with technology, like I can pretty much find every house I want. Or even you see the stuff like Open Door and OfferPad are doing, you can literally go to the house and show yourself. You don't need an agent to show their houses because they own them. They have a process for that. It's definitely gotten away from, like, I remember growing up, my parents were looking at a house and like the board of realtors every week would like literally print like binders. And like, it would be like, hey, here's this new house. And your agent would like bring you like, literally bring you like the list of the houses this week. Cause like, unless you drove by them, you didn't know they existed. Kind of pre-internet days because I'm old, but the internet has made all of that much more of a level playing field. And I mean, I know whenever I've ever bought a house, I see it on Zillow, I see it on Redfin. And then I tell, I mean, previously I've told my agent, hey, I like this one or I want this one. Let's go look at it. It's rarely them, I guess, really finding it for me, but it's always like you've never had any other option.
Yeah. And the biggest things that I'm going to see, I think that I agree with you. I think there's going to be a lot more flat rate commissions versus a percentage. I think that they're probably going to offer multiple different like packages or tiers, I would maybe call it. So, you know, the lowest level, you can get into the house. You know, the step above that, they'll write you the offer. Step above that, maybe they walk you through the process, like how to order inspections, appraisals, all that sort of stuff. So I think that's definitely what it's going to shift towards. I think second, is I can see a lot of agents maybe starting to partner with some of the bigger brokerages and the bigger like online companies. So Zillow, Redfin, that sort of stuff. Because if people are doing their own homework, like if someone says, hey, I want to look up some houses for sale in the area, like they're going on Zillow, right? They're going on realtor.com to look at that stuff. And so if you're like a small time agent, like how are you ever going to get in front of buyers without doing your own marketing? But with the newer generation being more tech savvy and stuff being more accessible, like the internet's kind of the easy button, right? So I can see a lot of people trying to maybe partner with them. And then third, I think it's going to, yeah, weed a lot of the people out, the bad agents out. And I think buyers agents are going to have to like hustle a lot more, which I think is not necessarily a bad thing. And the other one that just popped in my head too, I can see open houses being more popular, I guess, because if in an open house, like anyone can walk in. So you don't need a buyer's agent to represent you. Like you can just walk in yourself, check it out. And that in turn maybe gives the seller's agent an opportunity to charge, you know, maybe their normal 3% or whatever. And if they're able to find a buyer, maybe they charge an extra fee for that. I don't really know. That's a possibility, but then you get into the whole conflict of interest. So I don't know.
Yeah. Or it's just a thing where buyers get like better deals on stuff. And I think, you know, there's kind of the, you'll hear the sentiment when people talk about this of, hey, we think at some level it will bring down real estate prices. I mean, not like forever, but if you're able to kind of get rid of 3% across the board or 2% or whatever that looks like, which has always just kind of been baked into what the buyer, you know, the buyer's, you know, paying for, what the seller's giving out, all that stuff. So I think there'll be some of that. You know, I think, yeah, there's definitely going to be more, you know, packages around that of, you know, not so much a purchase price based thing, but just a level of service. And then there's the, I guess the concern or fear I have is, you know, for, and there's going to be a lot of people going directly to the, you know, listing agent too, cutting out the buyer's agent completely, you know, which if you're a savvy buyer, it makes sense. You know, I would be very confident in either of our abilities to buy a house without an agent because we do it. But as a first time home buyer, that's a lot scarier because you don't know what you're getting into. So I guess my fear around some of that is you actually do take these professionals out of the situation that can provide a lot of value and help when they're good. And I think people, hopefully not, but I think there's going to be people that end up buying things and getting into really bad situations with houses because they don't know that process. Like I think of someone I know locally who this year almost, you know, got into a really bad situation with a house because he didn't know how it worked. And he saw, like he went to an open house or saw a sign, called the agent. The agent that was selling the house was like, I'll just work with you directly. And she also flipped the house. And so it was the owner, it was the agent. And then she's like, I'll just, you know, I can represent you too, but made him sign a non-representation agreement of like, hey, I don't have your interest in mind. Like you can buy it from me directly. And, you know, I'm going to save a commission. I'm going to get everything I want. And, you know, in turn, he didn't get an inspection because he didn't know you're supposed to get an inspection. She didn't tell him to get an inspection because she's like, I don't represent you. The appraisal came back. It came back way too low because this house was overpriced. She just wanted him to pay the difference. Didn't have anyone explaining that how any of this process works. And then I randomly just kind of stepped in here of like, he just asked me some questions like, does this sound off? And was like, did you get an inspection? He's like, what's that? Oh, where'd the appraisal come in at? Like, he's like, well, why does that matter? So all of these things where he was able to kind of unwind that, end up buying the house for $40,000, $50,000 less. But I see the potential for a lot of situations like that when we kind of take the buyer's agent out of it with, you know, people who lack experience.
Yeah, to take that step further, I'm curious if there's going to be more lawsuits arising out of what you just said of buyers getting into a bad situation than saying, hey, the seller's realtor, they misled me. They told me just to sign here, here, here. They weren't very clear. And in the sue happy, you know, environment that we are in, I could see that being a thing. And I've always said this, that a good agent, a good buyer's agent, I will happily pay them their commission. Like that 3%.
Well, they easily pay for themselves, yeah, right?
Like they're 1,000% worth of money. A valuable agent is worth every single penny. So I guess that's kind of my last thought is the good agents, you know, I hope that they still make good money. I hope that they still are able to provide that great level of service like they were before.
Awesome. Well, we'll just kind of leave you guys with that. And of course, if you guys need agents, need our recommendations, we are always glad to share those. We have good people we work with that we'd love to connect you with. And yeah, if you have feedback for us, we'd love to hear that on the podcast, whether that's things you like, don't like, you know, things you wish we'd talk about or not talk about, any of that. People you want on the show, we're going to start interviewing more guests. Yeah, so love your feedback. If you could like, share, leave us a review, all that good stuff, all that helps, and we appreciate it. If you want to connect with us, we're pretty active on Instagram. Try the best way to find us. I'm at aaron.beal. Jason is at investor Jason Lee. And yeah, that's all we got. So until next week, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye, guys.